Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley. Supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. Tallahassee Regional Airport, offering service through Delta Airlines and Delta Connection partner ExpressJet, with direct flights from Tallahassee to Atlanta connecting to over 315 destinations worldwide. Fares and information available online at delta.com. And from HR Florida State Council, representing 16,000 human resource professionals and 6,300 Florida employers. HR Florida State Council, a resource for workplace best practices for the media, lawmakers, and Florida's human resource professionals. HRFlorida.org. WFSU-FM Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
The Reverend Al Sharpton and somewhere around 1,000 other folks gather in Tallahassee today to march and rally against Florida's Stand Your Ground gun law.
I didn't come down here to start trouble. I come down here to stop trouble.
Also tonight, lawmakers consider the creation of a new statewide sex offender task force, although there are those who wonder if that's really necessary.
People that are already caught are less likely to reoffend than the ones who we haven't identified yet.
We'll also learn about yet more possible changes to Florida election laws, allowing students to take exams online and making sure no one can confuse family arcades with the now banned internet cafes. I'm Tom Flanagan. It's week two of the 2014 Florida lawmaking session, and this is Capitol Report. Hundreds of people marched on the state capitol this morning to protest Florida's Stand Your Ground law. As Sasha Cordner reports, they were led by the Reverend Al Sharpton and the parents of two slain teens.
Chanting phrases like "No Stand Your Ground" and "No Justice, No Peace," the Reverend Al Sharpton led a march from the Leon County Civic Center to the steps of the Florida Capitol building.
Marching brings attention and rallies the focus of the nation. Dr. King tore down the walls of segregation with marching. Marching doesn't solve a problem, it exposes a problem. This law is a problem.
The law says people have the right to stand their ground and meet force with force, including deadly force, if they're in a situation that they feel could result in death or great bodily harm.
No peace!
No justice!
No peace!
Linking arms with the mothers of Jordan Davis and Trayvon Martin, the two slain teens, Sharpton ended the march on the front steps of the Florida Capitol building with an hour-long rally.
I brought both my daughters to march because they could be in one of these Stand Your Ground states
and could be a victim. Right.
So we're not just marching for Trayvon.
That's right.
We're not just marching for Jordan.
That's right.
We're not just marching for Michael Giles. We're marching for our children.
That's right.
Jordan Davis's mother, Lucia McBath, wore a shirt with her son's picture on it as she marched and rallied protesters. Jurors were deadlocked last month on a first-degree murder charge against Michael Dunn, who fatally shot the 17-year-old outside a Jacksonville convenience store following a dispute over loud music. But Dunn is facing at least 60 years in prison for the attempted murder of three teens who were in the car with a Georgia teen. Still, McBath says there's no doubt in her mind Dunn is at fault, but so is the controversial law.
My son's life was cut short by three bullets that pierced his organs and robbed him of his very last breath. But it was a shady law known as Stand Your Ground that robbed his father and I of any hope for justice. So I stand before you today on behalf of Jordan's father and my family. We will continue to fight and we will continue to stand. We are not going away.
Trayvon Martin's parents, Tracy Martin and Sabrina Fulton, were also in attendance. The 17-year-old lost his life after Neighborhood Watch volunteer George Zimmerman fatally shot the unarmed teen. Zimmerman was later acquitted, and Fulton says Florida deserves an F.
Because right now, Florida is failing us. Florida is failing our teenagers. Florida is failing our young men and women. Florida has to change this law now.
Yeah.
There's a bipartisan compromise being worked out in the Senate, led by Senate Democratic leader Chris Smith and Altamont Springs Republican Senator David Simmons, the main author of Stand Your Ground. But Sharpton and others criticize the changes for not going far enough. And Smith says he agrees.
I say they're correct. I think it should go further, and I want it to go further, and we're going to still keep working to make it go further.
Smith says he's continuing to work on the Senate's so-called tweak of the law in hopes that it will get heard this year. Meanwhile, the Republican-led Florida legislature has been resistant to making changes to the law. A repealer bill already failed in its first House hearing last year. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Cordner.
A bill that would create a new statewide sex offender task force within the Florida Attorney General's office got a green light from a House committee today. But as Ryan Bank reports, there are those who wonder if another statewide task force is the best way to go.
Fernandina Beach Republican Representative Janet Atkins held a town hall meeting in her district last summer, shortly after the abduction and murder of a Jacksonville girl by a registered sexual predator. Since that gathering, both houses of the Florida legislature worked in concert to create a package of bills dealing with sexually violent predators and sexual offenders. Those proposed measures, likely to pass, mostly deal with the monitoring of cooperative registrants. But Atkins says the patchwork of new bills left something out: a plan to wrangle those who flee the registry altogether.
This bill creates the Sexual Predator and Sexual Offender Strike Force within the Office of the Attorney General. The purpose of this strike force would be to shine a very bright light on those registered sex offenders and sexual predators who have absconded from supervision.
The team would work much like other task forces within the Attorney General's office. The Attorney General would serve as the board's chair, the Executive Director of the Department of Law Enforcement as vice chair, and officials from the Department of Children and Families and various local law enforcement officials from around the state would make up the bulk. Their task? Compile local, state, and federal lists of registry absconders to actively pursue. Dr. Suzanne Klein, the former head of the state's Sexually Violent Predator Program, says although she agrees with the bill's intent, creating a new task force might divert attention from preventing new crimes as the focus shifts to recapturing runaways.
People that are already caught are less likely to reoffend than the ones who we haven't identified yet. So pulling our resources and making, doing bills, things like that, to try and identify people that we haven't already identified, I think would serve our state better. But I can certainly understand why, you know, people, they want to make sure they know where all the sex offenders are.
And in a state that has close to 8,000 registered predators and offenders, knowing where they all are is a Herculean task. However, estimates of the number of absconders remain comparatively low. According to the Department of Corrections, which oversees most of the efforts to recapture those who don't meet their obligations, close to 380 offenders and predators have disappeared. The Florida Department of Law Enforcement, though, puts that number much higher, at close to 800. Atkins says fixing that disparity is reason enough to create the task force. What's more, she says not pursuing registry truants sends the wrong message to criminals.
Listen, to say that it's the law, but we really don't sort of mean it, and if you break the law, then we're really not going to go after you, sends the absolute wrong message to these sexual offenders and sexual predators.
But much of the bill's debate in the House Criminal Justice Subcommittee focused on another issue. Palm Springs Democratic Representative David Kerner worried allowing task force members to hold positions in local government could present a conflict of interest.
This can be interpreted as an office that is being held by one of the members. Even though the legislature is prohibited from being on this particular strike force, if a local mayor or somebody that holds an office also holds this office, there could be a dual office holding issue.
Kerner says he'd want to clarify that a strike force seat wouldn't be considered an office and advise subsequent committees to look into amending the bill to reflect that. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Ryan Bank.
Still to come on Capitol Report, a Florida Senate committee considers still more changes to the state's election laws.
If you're registering for the first time ever, you would have to cast your first ever ballot in person after registering online.
Besides possibly registering to vote online, would it be possible for more Florida students to take their exams online as well?
And can we get there towards the goal of 17, 18 to have that 1 meg per student goal?
Lawmakers are working to clean up some unintended consequences from an internet cafe ban last year. And we'll have a special report from some of Florida's meanest streets. We'll ride along with a former call girl who's trying to convince today's prostitutes to give up the life and try something better.
Support for Capital Report is provided by The Able Trust, encouraging businesses to hire workers with disabilities. Information about the benefits of hiring people with a wide range of disabilities is available on the web at lookatmyability.org. The Able Trust, empowerment, education, employment.
Florida Public Radio's Jessica Palumbo joins us. And Jessica, you've been following some action down in the Senate in regards to some proposed changes to Florida's election laws. It seems as though we have had many such changes in the past several years. What's the latest? What are they looking at?
Okay, well, today in the Senate Ethics and Elections Committee, we're looking at first is the creation of an online voter registration system. And this would allow voters to update their information, or you can register for the first time to vote completely online. No more killing trees by having to mail in a new registration form every time you move. So the system relies on State Department of Motor Vehicles records to double-check the name and the birthday that you enter, and it also grabs the digital signature that you have on file with the Department of Motor Vehicles. If you're registering for the first time ever, you would have to cast your first ever ballot in person after registering online. And there are a couple of exceptions to that, too. So if you're over age 65 or active duty military, or if you have a disability, then you can still vote absentee. And in the House, Democratic Tallahassee Representative Alan Williams has filed a bill doing basically the same thing, creating that online voter registration. And his bill has not been scheduled for a committee yet.
All right, so we have movement then in the Senate, but no concurrent movement in the House of another bill. You said the Senate was looking at a few other changes to voting laws, though.
Yes, the next change would be to absentee ballots and the way that people can return those to their election supervisors. Senate Ethics and Elections Committee Chairman Jacklet Valla has said he wants to clarify where absentee ballots can be dropped off. And some background on this, came to the forefront during a recent congressional special election, which we're on the eve of today, to replace the late Congressman Bill Young. 2 weeks before the January primary in that election, Secretary of State Ken Detzner issued a special directive that election supervisors could not accept absentee or those mail-in ballots anywhere except for their offices. So there are satellite locations where a lot of election supervisors do take those ballots. Today, I talked with Pinellas County Election Supervisor Deborah Clark, and she says that directive came just at the same time she was about to mail out about 80,000 absentee ballots. In Pinellas, she says voters are used to being able to drop off those ballots at 11 sites around the county, and those include post offices, libraries, tax collector's offices. She says those are ballot boxes like any other ballot boxes. They're staffed by election supervisor deputies who've taken an oath. They go through the same auditing procedures. And she says she's perfectly within her legal rights to continue using those. And in fact, 39% of the voters who've cast early ballots in that election have submitted their ballots through those boxes. Supervisor Clark says she supports anything that expands the opportunity for early voting, and that's what she sees with these sites.
In week two of the Florida legislative session for 2014, the state's election law is still somewhat in a state of flux and a fluid kind of thing. We appreciate the update, Florida Public Radio's Jessica Palumbo. Thanks, Jessica.
Thanks, Tom.
In the next few years, Florida students will be taking more of their state exams online. Textbooks will be replaced by MacBooks, but the schools will largely remain the same. As Lynn Hatter reports, many of those facilities are not equipped to handle the digital revolution that's underway.
Florida has a goal. By the 2017-2018 school year, Florida districts will have a ratio of 100 megabits of download capacity per 1,000 students. According to Department of Management Services Director of Telecommunications Ed Peters, that's what the state estimates it will need to support computer-based exams.
Now, that was for online assessments associated with PARC and some of the things that you're looking at here. So the compliance ratio was developed by learning what the school has today and comparing it against that benchmark of what they may need to have next year.
Even though Florida may not choose to administer the Common Core-aligned PARC exams, whatever test replaces the state's outgoing Florida Comprehensive Assessment exam must be able to run online. But districts vary greatly in terms of broadband capacity. For example, Jefferson County in North Florida has only one school. There are so few students, the district is already in compliance with the state's goal. However, that's not the case in larger, more urban and developed communities. Peter says an area's population largely determines its readiness, not its median income level.
What drives the service providers is profit, being able to earn a living and keep the business going. So that profit comes primarily from population-dense areas. So where you have a higher density of people residing, then there's a need for more bandwidth going in because more people are trying to access the internet. That may not always correspond to affluence and poverty.
The state has been trying to improve schools' internet capabilities for years. A 2012 Florida Department of Education study found about a third of the state's public schools did not have wireless internet service, and 263 buildings didn't have basic broadband. At the time, the state estimated it would cost more than $400 million to shore up digital infrastructure and purchase more laptops and tablets. In recent years, the state hasn't come close to funding that request. Last year, Florida lawmakers gave about $80 million to shore up schools' digital capacity, and the issue is again up for debate, says Miami Republican Representative Eric Frezen.
Between now and obviously by the time we're done with the budget, we're going to try to map out from a monetary standpoint, how do we fund that? How do we fund to make sure that each one of these components that were just laid out on this diagram are met, and can we get there towards the goal of 17-18 to have that that 1 meg per student goal?
Frezen chairs the House Appropriations Committee, which will begin putting together its 2014-2015 funding proposal next week. Meanwhile, at its upcoming meeting, the State Board of Education will also be taking a look at its digital inventory. According to a separate analysis by the Florida Department of Education, about 70% of schools are meeting the state's current wireless and broadband targets, still far off from the one-to-one ratio the state hopes to achieve. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
When lawmakers passed a measure last session to crack down on internet cafes running illegal gaming operations, some worried the bill also meant game over for family arcades. Regan McCarthy reports a measure filed this year is aimed at backing off on some of those rules so those businesses can stay open without gambling on the possibility of a lawsuit.
Capitol Lanes in Tallahassee is more than just a bowling alley. It also houses a bar and a sizable arcade.
Be a winner!
Director of Operations Daniel Peasy says about 15% of the business's income comes from those games. And he says a legislative change last year left his company operating in what he calls something of a legal gray area.
I know within our industry, because I'm a member of the BCAF, which is the Bowling Centers Association of Florida, and I know at our meetings, you know, we all know that the knock could come tomorrow. And, you know, basically what we do is we just keep operating the way we've always operated and pray that that doesn't happen.
Peasy says when lawmakers sped an internet cafe ban through the legislature last year, the measure had what he thinks were unintended consequences. Games with some element of skill used to be allowed, but changes last year meant games of chance and games of skill were both prohibited unless the game centers could bear to earn an exemption, such as having at least 50 arcade-style machines and giving out prizes valued at 75 cents or less per game. But Peasy says while he's not clear on whether he's following all the rules, nobody has asked him to close and he has no plans to. He says his business isn't the kind of place lawmakers wanted to shutter.
We just want to be able to continue to do what we've always done before this whole change in the bill happened. I don't think, and I, you know, obviously I can't speak for the 156 bowling centers, but I would seriously doubt that anyone has ever gone to a bowling center in Florida and blew their entire paycheck, left their kids hungry, couldn't pay the rent because they were playing a crane game.
And PZ isn't the only one who's confused by the state's new rules.
I take my grandchildren off, and I often wondered last year if I was breaking the law somewhere.
That's Tallahassee Democratic Senator Bill Montford. He's a member of the Senate Gaming Committee, which took up a bill to clarify the state's rules Monday. Lakeland Republican Senator Kelly Stargell filed the bill.
My intention is to hit just the games that are played for amusement, with skill, for fun, not to get rich.
Stargell's bill redefines what kinds of games are allowed and what kinds of establishments can operate them. It also increases the prize value from 75 cents to $5.25, but specifies those prizes must be redeemed on site. Peasy says he's happy with the proposal.
I'm supporting getting it written in such a way to allow us to continue to do what we've always done.
The measure passed the committee, but some raised concerns about whether the bill would create openings for unsavory businesses to start back up. Meanwhile, others questioned whether the bill shouldn't be expanded to make room for senior arcades, which tended to give out prizes not redeemable on site. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
You're listening to Capitol Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Now here's Ronald J. Eben with a look ahead to tomorrow's action at the Florida Capitol.
The Florida Senate convenes at 9:30 on Tuesday morning. An e-cigarette bill is on the agenda. The measure by Senator Elizabeth Nakista would ban the sale of electronic cigarettes to minors. Also up for discussion, what's being called the Florida GI Bill. It includes an increase in educational aid and job assistance for veterans and National Guard members. Another bill before the Senate is aimed at bolstering regulation of assisted living facilities. The House Health Innovation Subcommittee will take up a bill that could ensure the continued operation of trauma centers in Manatee, Pasco, and Marion counties. That meeting at 9:30. Also at 9:30 Tuesday morning, the House Justice Appropriation Subcommittee will consider a proposal to change state sentencing laws dealing with juveniles who commit murders or other serious felonies. State lawmakers are seeking a way to comply with a U.S. Supreme Court decision said that juveniles convicted of murder cannot face mandatory sentences of life in prison without the possibility of parole. The full House convenes at 3 p.m. and on the agenda, sexual predator and technology bills. At 4 p.m., the Senate Health Policy Committee will consider a bill that would legalize a marijuana extract that supporters say can help children with a rare form of epilepsy known as Charlotte's Web. Those are some of the items that legislators will deal with on Tuesday, March 11th. I'm Ronald J. Eben.
Finally tonight, an up-close look at a world not many people see. It's the world of prostitutes, pimps, drugs, and some brave efforts to change that world for the better. David McSwain with the Sarasota Herald Tribune put together this report.
Okay, hi, I'm Heather. Just to tell you a little bit about myself, I got into prostitution at age 11. I was kind of forced into prostitution at 11, manipulated, and I was abducted by a pimp. I've been out now 10 years out of prostitution. We're out riding around showing where the girls are and what they go through on a daily basis.
From the inside of a minivan, Heather Case scans the sidewalks and unlit corners of the Tamiami Trail in Bradenton, looking for women and girls. You couldn't tell by her dress or jovial disposition, but Heather estimates she's been arrested about 300 times for prostitution. But now Heather volunteers for Sail Off Freedom, a nonprofit that scours the neighborhood and connects prostituted women with clothing and safe housing. This section of the trail is a known prostitution area. It's where Heather turned her first trick. It doesn't take long for her to spot a woman standing feebly under a stop sign.
I'm good. How are you, babe? Right? It's just us girls. Not looking for your pretty self.
No, you're lying.
No, I'm not.
Why? What are you girls up to?
Nothing.
I'm very flattered. Thank you.
You're so pretty.
Really, really?
I seen you smiling. I was like,
I know. I
just want to share something with you. I used to be out here.
Thank you. I'm almost done.
The woman says she's out here making money for her boyfriend. Her boyfriend, Heather knows, is actually her pimp. To anyone else, the woman appears to be what law enforcement dubs a streetwalker, another word for a common prostitute. But Heather, like most survivors, sees her as a victim of immense sexual, physical, and mental abuse, which often began in childhood.
Turn down this street up here to the right. This is a really prostitution area. The traffic was running through here constantly. When I was underage, I walked back here a lot. Yeah.
Hours later, Heather spots a young girl sitting on the curb of a closed-down Quick Stop. She appears 15 and is wearing a white skirt and pink shirt. The girl's pimp rides his bike and circles around her. Heather's minivan stops, and the girl walks toward Heather. Worried she will scare the girl away, Heather quickly hides her microphone in her lap. Trudy Novicki is the director of Christie House, a child advocacy center in Miami.
We were working with a lot of these kids already, but we just hadn't identified them, and we weren't asking the right questions.
Novicki is the author of the Safe Harbor Law, but even she says it doesn't do enough to protect victims because it didn't lay out a clear enough plan to fund and staff safe houses. The law also does little to ensure victims end up in a home with mental health counselors instead of a jail. Sometimes, she says, jail is the only option for police agencies who have nowhere else to take a girl who is being prostituted. Currently, there are only 12 beds designated specifically for victims of sex trafficking in the entire state. State House Representative Eric Fresen of Miami is one of the lawmakers who hopes to fix that.
Not all victims are created equally, for lack of a better term. There are different stages of trauma that they've gone through, depending on how long they've been trafficked, depending on what the origin of their trafficking was, whether or not they were actually, you know, immigrants and then were trafficked in that sense, or whether they were runaways to begin with, whether they were in the foster system prior to being trafficked. So, you know, all those circumstances are different.
Many of the details are still being worked out, like which facilities or foster homes can be licensed to care for trafficking victims. Another wrinkle is the bill's mandate for secure facilities where children are essentially locked in to keep them from running away and to keep out drugs and pimps. Some advocates say locking children down will do more harm than good, but state officials say there needs to be some measure in place to protect traumatized kids from perpetrators and themselves. I'm David McSwain with the Sarasota Herald Tribune.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Sasha Cordner, Ronald J. Evan, Lynn Hatter, Stan Jastrzebski, Regan McCarthy, and Jessica Palumbo, along with Ryan Bank. We also thank our contributing Florida public radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at FPRCapReport. And join us again each weeknight during the 2014 Florida lawmaking session for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809, extension 358. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows at fprn.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following: a grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley, supporting public radio and taking time to care, on the web at searcylaw.com. Tallahassee Regional Airport, offering service through Delta Airlines and Delta Connection partner ExpressJet, with direct flights from Tallahassee to Atlanta connecting to over 315 destinations worldwide. Fares and information available online at delta.com. And from HR Florida State Council, representing 16,000 human resource professionals and 6,300 Florida employers. HR Florida State Council, a resource for workplace best practices for the media, lawmakers, and Florida's human resource professionals. HRFlorida.org. WFSU-FM Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.